From Nevada Public Radio, I'm Paul Boger. This is State of Nevada. Ballots are in the mail and early voting begins this Saturday, May 23rd. For all intents and purposes, the 2026 primary election is underway. With hundreds of names appearing on ballots across the state, we're helping you out by taking some time and breaking down key races and issues. Joining me to do that is April Corbin-Gurnis, deputy editor of the Nevada Current, and Ben Marjot, reporter for KRNV-TV in Reno and host of the Ballot Battleground Nevada podcast. Ben, April, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having me.
April, I want to start with you on the top of the ballot this year. That means congressional races. All three Southern Nevada Democratic representatives are running for re-election: Dina Titus, Susie Lee, Stephen Horsford. We've spoken to these folks several times over the years, so let's talk about their challengers. Are any of them facing a tough primary challenge?
Yeah, so Stephen Horsford doesn't have a Democratic primary challenger this year, so he got off lucky on that front. Dina Titus does have three challengers. They would be very long-shot challengers, for sure. Probably more of a challenge would be for Susie Lee, who's being challenged by a sort of self-funded cardiologist here in town, Dr. James Lally. He's really attacked her on her sort of adherence to being bipartisan. He sort of makes the argument that this is not the time for reaching across the aisle. He sees her as sort of enabling the Trump administration and not being hard enough on that, and not speaking out enough about genocide in Gaza, and sort of that his position there. Again, probably a long shot in terms of him actually unseating her. Nobody's predicting that, but it will be a good sense of how Democrats feel about Susie Lee in general and the strength and energy behind her.
What do we know about the Republicans looking to challenge them in the general election?
Yeah, so obviously when it comes to the Republican Party, the Trump endorsement is the big news for any candidate. And President Trump has endorsed Carrie Buck in CD1 to run against Titus eventually. And then he's backed Marty O'Donnell, who's a sort of video game composer. And those are the two races he's weighed in on. And so those are considered the front runners for those two in their respective primaries.
Ben, let's talk about CD2. It seems like things couldn't be more different in this election cycle. Earlier this year, longtime incumbent Mark Amadei announced he's retiring at the end of this Congress. Since then, more than two dozen candidates have filed to run for his seat. Have any front runners appeared?
Yeah, I think in the Republican side, there have been a couple of front runners carving out different lanes in this primary. There's Lieutenant Colonel David Flippo, who was running actually in Southern Nevada's Congressional District 4 for some time. And when learning that the Amadei seat up here in the north was opening up, flipped to run in the 2nd Congressional District. And he is, for the most part, self-funded, running in kind of the Trump lane, so to speak. He says he has not been endorsed by President Trump, who has not waded into this race yet, but he's certainly trying to carve out that lane as the Trump Republican of the race. And then you have a name familiar to you, Paul, and April, and James Settlemyer, the former Senate Minority Leader, a rancher from Douglas County, who served several sessions in the Nevada legislature in Carson City, was then more recently the director of Nevada's Department of Conservation and Natural Resources. I'd say those two, at least on the GOP side, have risen to the top. Some other names people might recognize: Fred Simon, who challenged Mark Amadei 2 years ago in the GOP primary, and then Jesse Watts, the former Eureka County Sheriff. But I'd say really it's probably at the top of the ballot where we're going to likely see Flippo and Settlemyer in some order. How that exactly plays out, that's why we have to wait and see.
What about on the Democratic side of the aisle?
Yeah, so Democrats are kind of sensing an opportunity, albeit I would say a small one, to flip this seat because it is so heavily Republican. It is drawn that way intentionally. And in my view, you know, there's been three candidates that have sort of risen to the top here in their kind of respective lanes. We have Greg Kidd, entrepreneur who ran as a nonpartisan in 2024. He has he's a very wealthy man, a ton of his own money to spend in this race, and he's been able to raise his name ID through running a couple years ago. Teresa Benitez Thompson, longtime assembly majority leader, I'd say maybe more of the establishment choice, very well connected up here in the north, and a lot of endorsements along that front. And then there's been this group of the so-called People's Democrats, five or so more progressive anti-establishment candidates candidates. A couple of them have dropped out. They kind of formed a pact. And so they have actually kind of circled the wagons around the one choice in that group who they perceived as having the strongest chance in kind of the progressive lane. And that's Morgan Wadsworth, a UNR student, comes from a family of ranchers. And she's been able to use social media to kind of raise her profile in that race. Probably still a long shot underdog. But those, are the three that have kind of risen to the top on that side.
Let's switch to the governor's race. There's about 20 candidates in all seeking the office. Six Republicans are looking to unseat incumbent Republican Governor Joe Lombardo in the primary. April, from what you've been able to cover, do any of these people have been able to make any headway in that effort?
Not really. A few of them have run before. A few of them ran during Lombardo's first campaign against him as Republicans. If you look at campaign finance reports, endorsements, none of the Republicans that are challenging Governor Lombardo sort of seem to have gained any momentum.
Six Democrats are also looking for the chance to make it to November's mm-hmm. ballot. Two names most people are probably familiar with at this point are Attorney General Aaron Ford and Washoe County Commissioner Alexis Hill. Ben, you're based in Washoe County, mm-hmm. so you might be slightly more familiar with Alexis Hill. What are some of the main issues that keep coming up in that primary?
Yeah, I'd say what has been interesting to political observers is that she has gained this reputation as more of a pragmatic legislator on the Washoe County Commission and practical and working with Republicans across the aisle. And now in this, more partisan contest, obviously running for governor, she's carving out the progressive lane. And so she's really focusing on taxing the wealthy, taxing gaming companies, mining companies. The soundbite that stands out to me was she told me any politician statewide in Nevada who doesn't talk about raising revenue in some way is, on the other hand, talking about cutting things. And so she's really centering her campaign around that. And then, on the flip side, of course, it's the front runner, Attorney General Aaron Ford, who has built a reputation on going after Trump, 40 plus lawsuits. I think he's won the vast majority of those in his now almost 8 years as, Nevada's top law enforcement officer, and less so focused on, those more progressive ideals. He is more of the establishment choice in this race.
There is a bevy of down ballot races that would take us more than an hour to get through this program, the program that we have. So let's talk about a few that you're keeping your eye on. Anything legislative, local, down ballot? Ben?
Yeah, I'd say for our Northern Nevada audience here, it has to be the Washoe County District Attorney's race. And the reason I say that is because it will be decided in June. There will be, for all intents and purposes, no general election contest because the only two that filed to run are the incumbent Chris Hicks and Sparks City Attorney Wes Duncan. And they're both Republicans. They face off in the June primary. Whoever wins that primary will be unopposed entirely in November. So this thing is done in less than a month. And so that one's absolutely critical. I don't know how much time we have, but I could talk about that one for a while because we did interviews with both candidates. It's focused on whether or not crime is going up or not. Certain individual cases that Chris Hicks's office has declined to prosecute for one reason or another, and then allegations of nepotism that have been levied against Hicks. That is a fascinating race and all important because it's decided here in just a few weeks.
A lot going on in that race. Sure to watch that. April, what are you watching?
I think not just for Southern Nevada, but for the entire state, I think the most interesting and probably competitive primary is the Attorney General's race, particularly on the Democratic side. It's between Senate Majority Leader Nicole Cannizzaro and Nevada State Treasurer Zach Conine. This is a race that has divided a lot of Democrats. You've seen dual endorsements from several groups. You've seen some people picking a side, but it's really a competitive race and getting kind of ugly on that side. But I'll leave it at that. But that's an interesting race for, I think, if Democrats are not paying attention to that. Specific further down ballot race, there are several state assembly and Senate seats that will be decided in this race. That includes Assembly District 15, which is Assemblymember Howard Watts, who's being challenged by a sort of SEIU member union-backed candidate named Miguel Davila, both highly qualified candidates. And that's also a race that seems a little bit like retribution for the film tax credit and the special session bill. Watts voted against that, and we've seen people come out against him for that. So that's playing out heavily in that race, and that is a race that will be decided this June in the primary. And also Senate District 2, that's on the east side of town, so you're looking part of North Las Vegas and also the east side. That's State Senator Edgar Flores. He's being challenged by North Las Vegas City Councilman Isaac Barone. That is a race that is being heavily funded by the building trades groups that heavily backed the film tax credit. Again, it's a race that's decided in the primary and has split people.
We have about a little less than 2 minutes left. And one thing we haven't talked about is voters. So what are you hearing from voters, April?
You know, I mean, voters are obviously worried about the economy and gas prices and affordability, housing, sort of the same issues we've seen a lot of the time. But they really want concrete plans on that. And that's the thing that I've heard from candidates and from voters saying that that's the most talked about topics on the campaign trail.
Ben?
Yeah, I would echo that sentiment for sure. It's the, you know, kitchen table issues, economy, affordability, gas prices. But I'll just throw another one in there, which is data centers. It has cropped up a lot up here in Northern Nevada. Governor Lombardo has come out, you know, kind of supportive of data centers. He was at a groundbreaking for one in Story County yesterday. And Alexis Hill has taken a stance against data centers. That's kind of emerged as a topic in the governor's Democratic primary. And so certainly the Reno mayor's race with the moratorium that the city is now imposing. So whether or not candidates are for or against data centers as the, you know, AI is growing and growing more, these centers are moving to Northern Nevada. That's going to be an issue that voters are paying very close attention to as well.
April Corbin-Gurnis is the deputy editor for the Nevada Courant. Ben Marjot is a reporter for KRNV-TV in Reno and the host of the podcast Ballot Battleground Nevada. April, Ben, thank you so much for your insight.
Oh, thank you.
It's great to be here. Thanks, Paul.
According to Nevada's Secretary of State, more than 1,100 people filed to run for federal, state, and local office in Nevada this year. And that doesn't even count the candidates running for judicial seats like district judge or state Supreme Court. With me to dive deeper into what this state election cycle could mean for Nevadans, I'm joined now by Warren Hardy and Dallas Harris. Hardy is a lobbyist and former Republican state senator. Harris is an attorney and former Democratic state senator. Warren, Dallas, welcome.
Hey. Good morning.
Dallas, let's talk about this election cycle in general. You know, what are you hearing from voters? You know, what are their top concerns?
Yeah, you know, I think everyone's looking at what's happening on the federal level and trying to figure out what does that mean for us here in our state. Cost of living, of course, I think is at the top of everyone's mind, mine included, right? When you're driving past the gas station, taking a look at what those prices are every day, hitting the grocery store and seeing, you know, the price of everyday items just going up. Cost of living, as I just said, is really at the top of the list, I think. We're going to have to see our leaders really speak to what they can do to make sure that Nevadans can get by on their paychecks. And that's going to be a tall order.
Warren, what about you? What are you hearing?
No, I would agree with Senator Harris. I mean, the interesting dynamic since the end of the Cold War, if the economy's not good, that's always the number one issue. That's always front of mind. You know, kitchen table issues. How's it impacting your quality of life? There were promises made by the current administration that just haven't come to fruition. And I think that just leads to a general sense of frustration among voters that, you know, is there anybody out there that can fix this problem? So it's always, you know, I think they're in the Clinton years. It's the economy, stupid. I mean, there were years during the Cold War, and I'm old enough to remember some of them, where international politics and challenges with Russia was front of mind over economics. But since the end of the Cold War, if the economy's not good, it's always the economy.
Something we haven't talked about a lot, but you alluded to it there a second ago, Warren, is President Trump and the current administration. You know, his approval numbers are in the mid-30s. About 60% of Americans say they disapprove of how he's handling the job. You know, President Trump isn't on the ballot. But I'm curious, Warren, how much of an impact do you think he and the administration is going to have on this election?
Well, it'll be the deciding factor. It almost always is in midterms, the popularity and where the president in power is. There's an interesting dynamic this time, however, because I really think this was setting, and I'm talking nationally now, because Nevada sometimes bucks that trend. Interestingly enough, what happened nationally is not always what happens in Nevada, but it was setting up to be a national bloodbath for Republicans, and still could be. But there's a lot of time, right? But the change, the dynamic this time that we've never had before is a gerrymandering wars, and what's going on in that regard. And Republicans have been able to create some seats out of thin air. That might stave off them losing control of the House and maybe even the Senate. But under a normal circumstance, but for that gerrymandering, you know, push, I think it's setting up to be a bloodbath for Republicans.
You know, the reason I brought him up is, you know, we have two Trump-endorsed challengers for Congress here. You have Marty O'Donnell, an educator Senator Kerry Buck, who are both trying to flip Nevada House districts. You know, he's endorsed those candidates. Does his endorsement carry the same weight here as it does in other states?
I mean, I don't think it does. I don't think it ever has, but it still carries a lot of weight. It can make a difference. We saw that last night with the Massey race, that President Trump's endorsement makes a big difference in a primary. Again, not quite as much in Nevada as it has in other states, but it could be the difference in those races. And then whether or not that person who, you know, moves far right MAGA can get elected in the general election is a question that we'll see. But yeah, it's still significant. Even with his declining numbers, the base, for the most part, on the far right is holding firm for him.
We've already seen politicians and organizations send out their endorsements for offices up and down the ballot across the state. Dallas, from your perspective, you know, how important are those endorsements for a candidate?
Yeah, super important. It's not just necessarily the name that comes with the endorsement, but often some of the monetary support, some of the foot soldiers, right, who can go out and knock doors for you once you receive an endorsement from a particular organization. Getting a lot of information about candidates is fairly difficult. And so we know that folks often look to their union or to a group that they know and participate in and respect for a slate of people to vote for, right? Those endorsements are key. That's why you see, and I personally spent a lot of time going out and seeking those endorsements, filling out those questionnaires, and making sure that folks knew who you had the support of, because it really does matter.
One person who has endorsed many candidates is Republican Governor Joe Lombardo. You know, we've already started to see the mudslinging between Lombardo and Attorney General Aaron Ford's campaigns. Lombardo has locked onto Ford for extensive national and international travel as the AG. Ford has done everything he can to tie Lombardo to President Trump. You know, is that effective messaging, Dallas?
Well, let me start with the travel messaging. I've only heard a couple of folks talk about this, and the things that I've heard people say is, well, is that the best thing that he's got, right? Is that the best shot that he has on the attorney general? Is that he's traveled quite a bit? And if so, that it's not quite sticking. If it is landing, I haven't heard that from folks. With respect to connecting the governor to the president, this is something that's been tried before. And it hasn't quite landed as well. I don't know if it's going to stick this time. If Ford has a chance of winning, I think it has to, given the president's numbers. But Governor Lombardo has been adept at getting just close enough to the president, but also somehow staying far away. I think he has to continue to walk that line, especially given where the president is. But we'll see how well he does in the general, and the battle is definitely on. So,
at this point, how effective are these negative attacks, Warren, considering the two camps aren't actually even running against each other at this point?
They're always effective. I mean, that's why they do them. If they weren't effective, they wouldn't do it. So negative campaigning, unfortunately, is effective, and it's largely because the electorate doesn't take the time to really dig in and figure it out. And the other thing I would say, and I do agree with Dallas on her analysis
of whether or not that's going to stick. But I can tell you in today's modern campaign, there's been focus groups. They've tested that message. They believe that it will work. Sometimes it's out of desperation, but there's a belief within the campaigns that that messaging will work. And it's always negative, and negative campaigning works. Anybody that tries to go positive usually loses. It's a sad commentary, but these campaigns now are scientific endeavors. They spend a lot of time on messaging, and I can tell you on the Lombardo side, I don't really know who's doing the Ford side, but on the Lombardo side, his folks are really good at that, at zeroing in on a message that's going to resonate with the public. So time will tell, right? I'm not saying they're infallible and they're perfect and they may be wrong, but in most cases, it's pretty scientifically arrived at.
Let's turn our attention to the state legislature where both of you served currently. It's gerrymandered to favor Democrats. At this point, is it even possible for Republicans to take control of the legislature, Dallas?
Sure. I think anything is possible. That's a great thing about our democracy, right? I mean, Republicans put up a candidate in every seat here, and they have a chance. Obviously my seat wasn't drawn safely. If we gerrymandered it, then I don't think that we were that effective, right? Every seat has a chance, and the electorate will decide.
Warren, what do you think?
Yeah, no, 2015 showed that anything can happen at any given time. I think if you sit down sort of as a political scientist, all things being equal, I think the Republicans could make a strong case they could win the Senate back with the right candidates. The challenge there is always the national atmospherics. And again, I think there's evidence that Nevada doesn't always go with what the national trends are. But I think unless something changes dramatically in the economy, I think it's going to be very hard for the Republicans to see that through. I do think, as I said, all things being equal, meaning the impact of the national elections doesn't have an impact, the economy doesn't have an impact, just on paper, I think the Senate's very winnable for the Republicans. Assembly, not so much, but unfortunately, all things aren't equal, or fortunately, depending on your point of view, all things aren't equal. And we do have the economy and we do have the national atmospherics. I think it's going to be hard.
While we're talking about the legislature, there's been quite a bit of backlash after last fall's special session where lawmakers voted against the multi-billion-dollar movie tax deal that would have seen the construction of sound stages and media production in Las Vegas. Trade unions in particular are backing challenges to lawmakers who voted against the bill. How big of a deal is that for Democrats, just in general, Dallas?
Yeah, it's a huge deal, right? I think as a Democratic politician, unions are a base of support that you depend on and generally need in an election. And so you really hate to see it when unions put their back in kind of getting rid of a Democratic candidate. It can be effective in elections. And, I think that it'll be a factor here.
I mentioned at the top of the segment that as many as 1,100 people are seeking office here in the state. Most of those folks are running for local office. You know, what are some of the races that you're keeping your eye on, Warren?
You know, I'm looking at Dallas mentioned something interesting. I've never seen organized unions that divided as I've seen it. I'm seeing in this time. And that matters a lot. So I'm looking at those races really closely. I'm looking at the Howard Watts race. I'm looking, at those types of races where the Democrats are divided and specifically the unions are divided. And that's just sort of my interest as a political scientist to look at those races. But, it occurs to me that when you have this type of thing, it can be frustrating and disruptive to the process. But at the end of the day, it's democracy, right? If you go to Carson City and you don't vote the way a group wants, it's their constitutional right to not only petition the government, but also to be involved in the electoral process. So as frustrating as it can be and as disruptive as can be, it's a sign of a healthy democracy to me.
So when it comes to local races, are you seeing much of the trade unions impact, or is that mostly on the state assembly, state legislature side?
I mean, it's always an impact, right? The Culinary Union is the Reid machine. I mean, I loved Senator Reid, was a friend of mine. I loved him dearly. The Reid machine was the Culinary and the labor union. So in any race the Culinary Union decides to be involved in, just because of the sheer number of boots they can put on the ground, that's going to impact every race. So where the Culinary has decided to be involved, they're going to have an impact every time, whether it's local or state or federal.
Dallas, let me ask you, what are some of the local races that you're keeping your eye on?
Well, you know, I think former Senator Hardy picked up on a really good one, and that's Assemblyman Howard Watts. His race is a close one to take a look at. You know, I have a lot of good friends who are on the city council. I've got a good friend running for city council in Henderson, so I'm keeping a close eye on that. Good luck, Jennifer Atlas. There's a lot of really good races, a lot of good folks out there running. Folks should make sure that they're involved this cycle. Local races really are the most important. They touch your life in the most direct way, right? It's the pothole right in front of your street getting fixed and filled efficiently. So I hope that people are taking an interest in their local races because they really do matter.
In that vein, what are some of the issues you think need more attention in this particular election cycle?
Oh, boy. Well, you know what? Like I said, the cost of living is kind of really getting all of the attention as it should. One thing I do think that is really been on my mind quite a bit, and I don't know if we think about a lot at the local level, and that's really just our democracy in general, how it functions, separation of powers, the importance of each branch kind of stepping up. You know, I don't want to be doomsday-y, right? But I think that some of those core principles are more important than ever. And, you know, as we think day-to-day about how we're living and functioning, which is so important and consumes our minds, right, making sure we're getting our bills paid, that's key. I also have been holding some space in my mind for the larger functions of our democracy and ensuring that they endure.
Warren, we have talked a lot about affordability. It feels like the last three election cycles now, including this one. So what do you think are some of the issues that need more attention this year?
Well, I think affordable housing. I mean, I think the focus has been to provide subsidized housing so that people can afford to get into housing. Well, that's not a sustainable model. That's something the taxpayers are going to have to pay for. I think there are concrete things we can do in the affordable housing space. I never thought I'd be back to the construction defect issue, but you know, we've got insurers out there that will not insure contractors to build condominiums. Well, condominiums is a natural affordable home ownership option that we don't build anymore. We build apartments, and that's the reason we're seeing rents go down, is because of the influx of apartments in Southern Nevada, and that's not a bad thing. But to provide the home ownership in an affordable way, that condo thing needs to be addressed. And again, we have insurance companies that won't write policies to allow you to build condominiums. So unfortunately, it's time to revisit construction defect again. I mean, we did it in 2005. I was right smack in the middle of it as a senator. Hoped I'd never have to do it again. But we were plowing new ground then. We really didn't know what we were asking for. And in some ways, we asked for the wrong thing. We asked for right to repair, which really hasn't had an impact. So there's things we can do immediately at the local level to address those types of things. And I just think that's an example of one of them. But we have to have the political will to identify the problem and not just band-aid it again.
And that is where we are going to have to leave it for today. Dallas Harris is a lawyer and former Democratic state senator. Warren Hardy is a lobbyist and former Republican state senator. Dallas, Warren, it's always good to hear from both of you. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Thanks, Paul.
Good to see you, Senator. Bye. Thank you.
It's not just in your head. Elections are actually getting more stressful. From 2016 to 2024, the share of Americans who reported feeling significant stress about presidential elections rose 17%. Election stress is now reported by nearly 70% of people responding to an American Psychological Association survey. Anxiety, depression, shorter tempers, loss of sleep, they're common symptoms of a condition some psychiatrists have informally called election stress disorder. As midterm election season continues to ramp up, why are people more stressed than before? And what can Nevadans do to protect their mental health for the rest of this year and then the next election cycle, 2028, which is sure to begin right after? To learn the answer, I spoke with Dr. Marcus Kemmelmeyer. He's the dean of UNR's graduate school, as well as a political and social psychologist.
Marcus, welcome to State of Nevada.
Thank you.
We often hear that partisanism is on the rise. Do we see a direct correlation between rates of polarization and voters' mental health issues, or is the increased stress coming from some other aspect of the modern political process?
You know, polarization has been going on for such a long time that it's really hard to say that the stress that somebody experiences just because of that. But it's very clear that we are in a time where we're exposed just to lots of stressors. There's high levels of uncertainty, economic distress that people are facing. People hear a lot of bickering, a lot of grandstanding, a lot of mutual accusations, lawsuits, what have you, and of certainly war in the news. That is makes it often very hard for people to keep the composure or not worry, especially when they relate what's happening to their own lives. Gas prices, rent going up. They've observed the increase in prices of groceries. All of that stuff is now part of our daily life, and people many times are fed up. And sometimes that means that they blame it on the political division. But that division actually has been around for decades now. These days, more often than not, people sort themselves into their own respective boxes, in their own respective camps, in many ways also to feel good about themselves, to say, hey, this is people like me, this is how we see the world. And any kind of stress you can deal much better with when you're not alone, if you don't feel by yourself. And that is the paradox of the polarization that people actually also found their in-group, they found their tribe.
You're kind of leading me to my next question there. So how do you prevent those political camps from descending into tribalism?
You know, that is the $64,000 question that lots of people have asked. And there are lots of initiatives around that. It's an ongoing challenge. We're never really quite done with it.
Nearly half of Americans surveyed by the Thriving Center of Psychology in 2024 were struggling with political burnout. It's more prevalent among Gen Z and millennials compared to Gen X and baby boomers. Is there a reason why younger generations feel more election stress than perhaps older generations?
I think there are two reasons. One, younger generations, fortunately, are more likely to talk about mental burden, distress, and their mental health. I think that's a really great development. It's no longer that much of a taboo than before, that you got to be tough, you got to just got to be there and take it. I think that's a great advantage. We're also a lot of people saying, you know, this really is a burden on me. On the other hand, people who are more likely to spend time online, who are digital natives, just like the generations that you just talked about, huh? They're more likely to hear a lot about it. They may see these kinds of posts come up in their feed that might expose them to this kind of messages. These days, also political campaigns, they know much more. They bombard young people because no, young people actually are a big prize electorally. You're much more likely to change the viewpoints of young people than of older people as a result of that they're disproportionately exposed to political messaging. And of course, political messaging that might be raging or vitriolic accusations.
Marcus Kemmelmeyer is the dean of UNR's graduate school, as well as a political and social psychologist. Marcus, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Joining me now is Jim Jobin. He's a psychotherapist, addiction counselor, and an adjunct professor with UNLV's Graduate School of Clinical Mental Health Counseling. Jim, welcome back to State of Nevada.
Paul, thanks so much for having me back. And with all due deference to my colleague at UNR, go Rebels.
We'll have to leave it there. I have lots of thoughts. The last time you were on the program was right after the 2024 presidential election. You said then that you saw a huge uptick in people talking about permanent decisions like sterilization, leaving the country, divorcing their partner, cutting off family members. Since then, have you heard people making the same sort of decisions, or have they gotten used to the new political norms?
You know, it's both. So on one hand, I think there was a little bit of a calming down after the immediate aftermath of the election. So we did see some people sort of moderate. But then the news cycles would continue to spin up, right? And we started hearing about ICE marching through streets and tariffs permeating the economy. And of course, now a war in Iran. And so many different things keep happening. And as that happens, I tend to notice some kind of uptick in real decisions in real people's lives, which it's tough, Paul. As a therapist, you're usually talking people down from making those big decisions, but these are real things that really matter in the world, and people are adapting as best they can.
How are people treating mental health issues? Are people turning to healthy coping mechanisms, or are they turning to more destructive behaviors?
Oh, humans gonna human, Paul. You know how we are. A lot of people are turning to those self-medicating options, especially in Nevada, since we've legalized cannabis and alcohol's on every corner. But of course, we shrinks are always trying to encourage people to reach for those higher values, to do better, to move their bodies, take that walk, get out and touch grass, which of course in Southern Nevada, we don't have any of. So we tell people to go touch a rock. But we want them to take those healthier approaches, but it's not always going to be the first thing people reach for. And so that's why we think about anxiety and stress as larger things than just mild inconveniences or small sufferings. It really affects the health of the human. Anxiety is anatomy. You're carrying all that cortisol, that adrenaline, it's affecting your actual health. And then you go out and you cope with all these stresses that you're feeling in usually really unhealthy ways. And that's a big part of what mental health professionals are trying to prevent.
Nevada is a swing state, meaning we get a lot of attention during national election cycles, especially when it comes to attack ads. What effect does that negativity have on people psychologically?
It's not good, you know, and this is a big part of, I think, the entire political spectrum. I mean, the number one motivating emotion that they can cause you to feel is fear, right, or rage. And so when humans are just constantly have that poured into them, especially as Nevadans, and we're very micro-targeted, a lot of money gets spent here, but with that same goal of terrorizing us or making us feel fearful of something. And you have to remember that Homo sapiens are skittish animals, Paul. You know, we grew up on the savannas of Africa. We don't have long, sharp nails or teeth. We survive by becoming alarmed very quickly. When we see a group of us scattering or making noise, we all panic and run in another direction. We're kind of herd animals in that way. So these ads work, and they manipulate our psychology, and they cause us to feel that incredible sense of fear. And so it's not good. It's not good for us as a people. It's not good for our biology, for our psychology, and frankly, for our society.
Therapists often advise more rather than less communication in general. But when it comes to politics, you know, a lot of families, a lot of folks find that the old adage, it's just better not to talk about politics or religion at the dinner table, to be the best course of action. So is it better to communicate through those differences, or should you just let, you know, sleeping dogs lie and agree to disagree?
It's family by family, you know, and I always tell folks, listen, I'm a big believer in authenticity, big believer in transparent communication. I want us to have community. Part of how we really do that is by encountering people that are different than us and holding space for the relationship. But I always remind people, make your priority the relationship. The purpose of your communication is not to win one more vote in one more direction or to get somebody to donate a few more dollars to a political candidate. You're talking to somebody you care about because you care about them. So enjoy a rigorous conversation, but always come back to the foundation of why why you are having it, because you like this person, because you want a relationship. And so if you begin with the end in mind and keep your conversation focused on ways that ultimately strengthen or better interlace your dynamic with that other person, it is then going to serve its purpose. And if that's your guiding mission in that conversation, you'll tend to keep the topic on the road and not go off-roading into the rage baiting and all the trolling that we tend to do. And hopefully we can salvage some family dinners that way.
That was Jim Jobin. He's a psychotherapist, addictions counselor, and adjunct professor with UNLV's Graduate School of Clinical Mental Health Counseling. Jim, thank you so much.
Thanks, Paul. Always a pleasure.
If you or anyone you know is struggling with stress or thoughts of self-harm, call the 988 Suicide and Crisis Hotline or text NAMI to 62640 to connect with a specialist from the National Alliance on Mental Illness. And we'll have more mental health resources linked on our website at knpr.org. There's never a shortage of what to see, hear, and do at any time in Nevada, and that includes the 2 weeks of early voting, which begins Saturday, May 23rd. So this week, we've decided to do something different. For those of you hitting the ballot box, we've picked some cultural options right near polling places in the Las Vegas Valley. Here with those suggestions is KNPR's Mike Pravat, who oversees the Arts and Culture Beat for Nevada Public Radio. Hi, Mike.
Hey, Paul.
Let's start with the libraries, a traditional voting destination. Cultural options abound at libraries anyway, so what's special during voting season?
Well, it's not so much anything is special, but as you said, there's always a ton of things to look at or do or visit or experience. My own closest polling place is a library, and when I'm done voting, I tend to hit the art galleries. Maybe I go into the proper part of the library and peruse the new arrival stacks. All to say that it's a good destination if you've got culture on the brain. Now, if you decide you are voting at, say, Sahara West Library, that is Las Vegas Clark County's branch with the largest gallery space. That's 6,000 square feet.
That's like visiting a small museum.
There was actually a small museum once there, the former Las Vegas Art Museum. That space now hosts up to 3 different exhibitions. Actually, that's how many are there right now. I'll go through them. In the larger studio room, Santa Fe-based artist Brian McPortland shows off his large-scale abstract paintings that opened last week, and it's up until August 1st. In the East Gallery, you have artist James Kim and the Korean Calligraphy Art Association. They're going to showcase their ink wash watercolor paintings. That opened yesterday.
And that's just in time for Asian American, Native Hawaiian, and Pacific Islander Heritage Month, by the way.
Great timing from their part. And that's going to be open until August 9th. And then finally, in the West Gallery, you have the students of the Clay Arts Vegas giving their take on Americana with their show, As American as the State Fair. And that debuts on May 21st. It closes on August 1st. Now, 2 reminders, Paul. All 3 exhibits have artist receptions on Thursday the 21st. Remember, that's going to be a little too early to also vote that day. And the libraries will be closed on Monday, May 25th, because that's Memorial Day.
That's a lot of art for one library. Do any of the other branches have one-off performances?
Yes, in fact, on May 29th and 30th, the Summerlin Library is staging Now I Get It, a play with music. And this play addresses the human toll of the Vietnam War. It's written by a veteran of that war. And Paul, I'm actually going to throw a wild card in here. If you are going to vote at UNLV's lead library, why not go on June 5th when Opera Las Vegas is staging Ruggero Leoncavo's one-act I, Pagliacci at the Judy Bailey Theater that night?
And why not? It's only the 3rd Opera Las Vegas production in 5 weeks. Libraries are fun, but a lot of people like voting at the mall, too. What do you have for them that doesn't involve shopping or playing at an arcade?
I got you covered here. So if you live in the West, the Meadows Mall is convenient and freeway adjacent. And it's also Springs Preserve adjacent.
And you know, some parents are going to be voting with their kids in tow.
Right. So why not take your undoubtedly patient kids across the street and check out the new Dino Safari walkthrough attraction? This experience, it combines interactive elements, which kids love, with about 30 audio animatronic dinosaurs.
Sounds like something from Disney Park.
Yeah, and I'm trying to avoid the dreaded immersive word here, but you're onto something, and yes, it is immersive. And that experience is going to open on Saturday, May 23rd. But just remember, parents, it's only here till September 7th.
And what about for those living or working on the east side?
As it happens, voting is available at the Boulevard Mall, but at the Seafood City Market. So when you're done voting there, you can head into the mall proper towards the north side, and you can experience the new Infinity Museum.
What is an Infinity Museum? Is it a place with a bunch of mirrored rooms?
Yep. It's a series of rooms that rely on lighting and reflection and objects to make you feel like you're in this like very vast, never-ending space. I'm still trying not to use the I word here, Paul, but it is fully encapsulating and fully going on your Instagram, inevitably. That is now open daily from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m.
Another kid-friendly option for you parental voters. I think we've got everyone covered. That's all the time we have for this week. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you, Paul.